ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 6th of April. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. US President Donald Trump has issued yet another deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz while threatening to bomb power plants across the country. Reporter Chantelle Al-Khoury joined me a short time ago from Washington, D.C.
Well, the president has repeatedly threatened to destroy Iran's energy infrastructure if the Strait of Hormuz isn't reopened, setting multiple deadlines, then delaying or walking them back. But it looks like the president is losing his patience. He's expressed his anger in a Truth Social post. It's Easter Sunday here in the United States, and he has said, quote, "Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped in one in Iran. There'll be nothing like it." And he's referring to his previous commitment to destroy energy infrastructure and major bridges if Iran does not open the shipping channel. He then went on to say, and you'll have to excuse my language, he says, "Open the effing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch." He then ended the post with a mocking reference of Islam. Now, the destruction of this vital civilian infrastructure in Iran by the US and Israel would cause widespread suffering. This is a population of around 93 million people, and legal experts warn that targeting them would constitute serious war crimes under international law. The comments also add to some of the contradictions we've been hearing repeatedly from the president, who just last week said that the US would not have anything to do with securing the strait. Despite this escalation, though, he's told US media that he believes an agreement could be reached as soon as tomorrow, or he'll consider blowing everything up and taking over the oil, in his words. Now, Iran's Central Military Command has responded, warning the gates of hell will be open for you.
All this comes, Chantelle, after the dramatic rescue of a US fighter pilot.
Yeah, that's right. This was a dramatic rescue that might have emboldened the president in his language. That search and rescue mission was to find a second crew member that was missing. He was the pilot from an F-15E fighter jet that was shot down over southwestern Iran. And that operation was successful for the US, who recovered both crew members. It was reportedly a military CIA operation involving hundreds of special forces troops. And Donald Trump says the second airman was seriously wounded. He claimed that Iran was, quote, "getting close to capturing him." Meanwhile, Iran says it destroyed two American transport planes and a helicopter during that rescue mission, labelling it a significant failure when they were talking about that US mission. They've also released images and videos that they claim to show the wreckage. Now, Washington has not released details, but there are also multiple outlets reporting that the US military blew up two of its own transport planes due to a technical malfunction during that operation as well.
Chantelle Al-Khoury in Washington, D.C. Palestinians living in the West Bank, fearful Jewish settlers are using the cover of Israel and the United States' war with Iran to unleash a wave of unprecedented violence across the territory. One Israeli human rights organization has said it documented more than 300 attacks against Palestinians in the first month of the war alone, with 10 people killed during that period. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
The Muammar family children are smiling today, playing in front of their house. But they're usually too scared to venture out unless their older siblings or parents are keeping watch for nearby danger.
Those settlers came here just to destroy our lives and force us to leave our houses.
Jamil Muammar is sitting on a plastic chair, the crutch he needs to aid his walking, lying on the ground next to him.
I was shot in the leg and my two brothers were martyred, and two more people were shot, one in the hand, the other in the shoulder.
The bullet which hit Jamil is still lodged in his leg. The attack on the Muammar family was recorded by other residents of the village they live in, Kariut, between Ramallah and Nablus, north of Jerusalem, in the occupied West Bank. The settlers can be seen clambering up the hillside to the olive grove alongside one of the Muammar family's homes. Some were armed with rocks, while others were brandishing rifles. At one point, Jamil's brothers, Muhammad and Fahim, can be seen surrounded by the settlers, pushing and shoving them, and one settler fires warning shots into the air. The pair then head back towards their homes before they are shot and killed. Muhammad was hit in the head and Fahim in the stomach. In a statement, the Israeli military told the ABC that the identity of the shooter is under investigation. That's despite Israeli media reporting they suspect he's a reservist and authorities have confiscated his weapon. The IDF went on to say it condemns the incident and views it with the utmost severity. But Jamil says he doesn't expect justice.
We know there is no hope. They will do nothing. We do not expect anything, even though there is a video showing the shooter.
There are more than 500,000 settlers living in 140 Jewish settlements in the West Bank, with another 200,000 in East Jerusalem. Kaliut is a village surrounded by those settlements, considered illegal under international law. They include the established communities of Shiloh and Eli, as well as a number of rudimentary outposts which have popped up in recent months. Local paramedic Bashar Kariuti is also an anti-settlement activist, monitoring the developments.
They are trying to connect the seven settlements on Kariut land together, because Kariut is in between and it became an issue that makes the settlers and the occupation nervous.
He says the incident which led to the recent shooting happened moments after the Muammar brothers and others in the community confronted a settler on a bulldozer trying to carve a new road through their olive groves to an outpost on top of a nearby hillside. Israeli media reported rocks were thrown at the driver. But Bashar says the settlers have been emboldened to act with impunity.
The settlers are supported by ministers in the Israeli government, Itamar Ben-Gvir. He is in charge of the police and is supporting the settlers by giving them weapons.
According to Jamil Muammar, the equation for his community is clear.
We will not leave. It's our land. But at the same time, no one is defending us.
This is Matthew Doran in Kariut in the occupied West Bank, reporting for AM.
Oil importing nations in Southeast Asia are experiencing a worsening economic crisis. The Philippines, which imports almost all of its oil from the Persian Gulf, declared a national energy emergency. Southeast Asia correspondent Tim Swanston filed this report from Manila.
Eddie Ramos is behind the wheel of his Jeepney, a colourful repurposed World War II Jeep used as a highly popular and low-cost public transport option in the Philippines. Jeepney drivers were some of the first to sound the alarm in recent weeks after prices for diesel rose from 55 to 130 pesos a litre. That's more than $3 Australian. It's made driving almost completely unaffordable, and Mr. Ramos says his earnings barely cover the cost of fuel.
We keep driving just so we have money for food. We're also renting a house, so it's difficult to keep up with the payments.
The Philippines is especially vulnerable to the energy crisis because almost all of its oil is imported from the Persian Gulf. The country has declared a national energy emergency and has brought in some COVID-era type measures to reduce oil use. Subsidies have been given to drivers, but on the streets, many drivers told us they weren't enough. Filipino economist Sir Pena Reyes said this war has laid bare the structural reliance of Philippines on imported fuel.
Our huge import dependence, it has become even more undeniable right now that a single geopolitical choke point can trigger a nationwide energy and economic crisis.
He and other experts say it's a wake-up call for the Philippines and other Southeast Asian countries to diversify their fuel sources and deepen fuel reserves. The Philippines has had to scramble, organising 1 million barrels of oil from other countries. It's also buying Russian oil after the US temporarily eased restrictions. The Philippines is reportedly receiving assurances from Iran that its ships can pass through the Strait of Hormuz. But the country is still at the mercy of enormously expensive global prices. In Manila's Baseco slums, families say they're already experiencing higher prices for food, and some have lost income. High fuel costs are already seeping into many sectors of the economy. The country's central bank has forecast that inflation could average above 5% this year. In a statement, the Philippines Department of Energy said while the country remains vulnerable to external developments, it's moving with urgency. This is Tim Swanston in Metropolitan Manila, reporting for AM.
Meanwhile, Australians heading home from an Easter road trip may pay slightly cheaper prices at the bowser today. The federal government's cut to the fuel excise seems to be having an impact, but prices are still far higher than they were a month ago. State governments are now working to improve data surveillance on service stations, as Isabel Masali reports.
What colour background would you guys like me to do for you?
That, like, pastel mint colour is really cute.
This one?
It's time for the finishing touches on this portrait. This outing to the markets and souvenir is a small treat for these friends in Perth. Steep fuel prices have made it even tougher to be a uni student and young worker.
I work in Carousel and I live in Balladura, so it's between like a 25 to 40 minute drive depending on traffic. And I am slowly getting to a point where I'm like, I may not be able to afford to go to work.
Yeah, I mean, driving to university, I only do it once, but it can be anywhere depending on traffic from about half an hour to 45 minutes. The fuel prices at the moment, they're giving me a heart attack every time I go and have a look.
This mum would have loved to be celebrating Easter with a road trip, but is enjoying a short outing.
The cost of living in general, as well as fuel prices, is definitely, made it a little bit harder, especially for a young family with, you know, one income coming through.
Like many other drivers, she checks a website that monitors service stations and their prices.
I used to just go to the local BP because it was closest, easy to do, but I'm definitely keeping a watch on where we can sort of save a little bit of money.
The WA government has announced the Fuel Watch scheme is being expanded to include all regional service stations, forcing them to report accurate prices. And they'll soon be required to report fuel outages. Energy Minister Amber Jade Sanderson.
We're also cracking down on retailers who do not comply with Fuel Watch. We are increasing the fines by 400%, from $1,000 to $4,000 for every time they breach.
On Sunday, the New South Wales government also revealed changes to its fuel check system. More than $2 million will go towards improving the site. And in the past fortnight, a compliance blitz has seen about 100 fines issued to service stations that had misleading prices. Now motorists are being urged to dob in retailers. Dr. Lurian De Mello welcomes these changes but is concerned about the timing. He's with Macquarie University's Transforming Energy Markets Research Centre.
The focus is kind of shifting onto price gouging and, you know, petrol stations behaving badly. I think the focus should be, you know, informing the public on how much supply is coming, informing the public on how our transport and logistics is operating. You know, I'd rather have an app where it informs petrol stations, in fact, when their tankers are arriving.
The federal government insists fuel supplies remain stable. Assistant Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade, Matt Thistlethwaite, speaking to Sky.
We've got about 39 days of petrol, about 30 days of diesel in Australia, and 50 ships scheduled to arrive over the course of the next month.
Assistant Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade, Matt Thistlethwaite, Isabel Masali reporting there. Well, it's one thing to have to pay a bit more for fuel in the city, but in the bush, the fuel crisis has many, many more dimensions to it. In the tourist gateway town of Foster in Victoria's lush South Gippsland region, the ripple effects can be found just about everywhere you look. Jeremy Story Carter has the story.
At the one pub in Foster, fuel is the talk of the town.
Talk to many people around here and everyone has some sort of opinion about the petrol or diesel prices here.
That's pub manager Anthea Bussatil. Sitting across the bar is truckie Chris Carnes. His two semi-trailers haven't moved all week.
Oh, it's pretty scary. Yeah, everything's dead. This is way worse than COVID, yeah.
Chris Carnes would normally deliver hay and other items to nearby farmers, but the jobs have all dried up. Government relief on the heavy vehicle road user charge and the fuel excise is welcome, but the war in the Middle East and the fuel crisis it has created have only compounded issues in communities like Foster. Across the road at the local cafe, Nicole Holder has been shutting up early.
We noticed a dramatic drop-off from last week to this week, and I've already started to think about the security of the business going forward.
At the same time, Nicole Holder's invoices are costing more due to increased fuel levies. She's not sure how much more she can absorb.
If we can't keep open at the same rate that we're used to, then I'm going to have to start reducing staff hours or hopefully not having to lay anybody off, but if it gets any worse than it is, then that could be a possibility.
The town is a gateway to Wilson's Prom National Park, but rooms in local accommodation spots sat vacant over Easter. The caravan park in Foster caters more to grey nomads than families, but it also has a series of year-round residents. That's who owner Christine Donaghy has in mind at the moment.
People are hard up. Like I said, we get calls. Noel will get, sometimes he might get two or three calls on in one day for people looking for a place to live who just have come to some situation where they're desperate.
She says they're worried they may soon have to raise prices. Over the fence at Junior's footy training, a group of parents discuss plans for carpooling to games this year and different ways to get around this uniquely challenging moment.
Yes, it's quite depressing, isn't it? Yeah. Can't ride a horse there either, a bit far.
Yeah. Are we starting to think about other modes of transport?
Yes, horses. Horse and cart. But even then, I don't think the horses are fit enough to actually go as far as you need them to go. It's really far away.
Example, I live 4Ks out of town. My boys have ridden their bike the last two mornings. Usually I would have to drive them.
So you're riding in, helping out?
Yeah, we'd be minding the school weight mostly every day.
Yeah. And do you know why that is? Have you had the chat about why it's a bit more expensive in the car at the moment?
To the fuel getting a lot more expensive, then we don't, have to pay for weight. Fulfill and not.
Dairy farmer Tanya Staley and her son in Foster. Ending that report from Jeremy Story Carter. Wi-Fi, polymer banknotes, cochlear implants, dual flush toilets, and of course the Hills Hoist. Australia really can be proud of its genius with inventions like these, none more so than the solar panel. Behind this remarkable story is a little-known Australian scientist whose technological breakthroughs are in 9 out of every 10 solar panels installed across the world today. Energy reporter Daniel Mercer.
On a glorious winter's day at Bronte in Sydney's eastern suburbs, a smartly dressed man in his 70s walks along a crowded beachfront. He weaves between surfers carrying boards, mums pushing prams, and any number of other passers-by. But no one seems to recognise him.
Yeah, I'm Martin Green from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, and I've been researching on solar cells for over 50 years and had a bit of success in developing new technology and having it commercialised.
In reality, Martin Green is no mere contributor to the rise of solar power. According to Australia's former chief scientist, Alan Finkel, he's arguably the seminal figure in its modern development.
I think that Martin, you could say, is one of our best-kept secrets. He has huge international stature amongst the world of solar photovoltaic experts and physicists.
When Martin Green first started to dabble in solar research in the 1970s, he says it was a technology that attracted little excitement.
One of the nuclear scientists or administrators of that era is on record as saying, you know, the impact of solar would be like a flea on an elephant's back.
But in an echo to the present turmoil gripping the global economy, it was the first Arab oil embargoes that gave the technology its lucky break.
It was a very exciting era, the mid to late 70s, because of this large program in the US and countries like Japan and Europe in general.
Thanks to those tailwinds, Martin Green would go on to change solar power forever. Alan Finkel says Martin Green's genius was in making solar panels much more efficient.
This PERC technology, it stands for Passive Emitted Resell Technology, reflects electrons off the back of the solar array. So it's in a sense like having a double shot.
Along with his technological breakthroughs, Martin Green also trained a generation of Chinese students who would go on to found the world's dominant solar manufacturing industry. Among them was Zheng Rongxi, who was the world's first solar billionaire before his company Suntech collapsed amid cutthroat competition by Chinese companies.
If without UNSW and Martin Green's work, it's hard to imagine and, you know, the solar industry become what it is today.
Amid the rancor and the rhetoric over global warming and the shift away from fossil fuels, Martin Green says many people are yet to fully appreciate the sheer scale of the global solar industry.
People aren't used to things changing as quickly as they've changed in the solar industry, or with the speed that the industry has developed from a small industry to one that could now, you know, very rapidly provide all the energy that the world needs.
Solar pioneer Martin Green, ending that report by Daniel Mercer. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.